Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On paper, today's guest, Dr. Wendy Suzuki, had it all. She was a world-renowned neuroscientist. She ran her own neuroscience research lab at New York University, and she earned tenure as a professor. And she wasn't even 40. While she had created a dream career for herself, she had no social life and felt pretty miserable. So she decided to conduct an experiment on herself. She realized that in order to be happy, she had to use all of her brain, not just the part of her brain that designed neuroscience experiments. She also had to get active and move. Big parts of the motor areas in her brain were not being used because she never exercised. She soon found herself focusing better, working smarter, and being more productive. She writes about her personal experience and the science behind the mind-body connection in her new book, Healthy Brain, Happy Life, a personal program to activate your brain and do everything better. So what does it take to sharpen our thinking and increase our memory capacity? Today, I'm joined by Wendy Suzuki, professor of neuroscience and psychology at New York University's Center for Neuroscience, where she also runs an interactive research lab. She's now also a certified fitness instructor, and she joins me in studio. Hi, Wendy. Thanks for coming in.
Hi, Rosie. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. I feel like I know so much about you because...
That's what a lot of people say now when they meet me.
You shared so much personal information in this book.
Yeah, well, it was... a real personal story. And I have to tell you that the book started out as a more typical science story. I was going to, as a professor of neuroscience, describe for you all of the science behind it. But it became so much more personal when I could tell you why I got interested in this. And it turned out that that was the most poignant way to be able to convey this information. So that's what the book became.
And also, it's probably more relatable to a lot of people.
I think so.
Because when you think about brain and the science behind it, it's fascinating.
Yeah.
But there are lots and lots of books about this now.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because you are a neuroscientist, mm-hmm. and yet you had these experiences of not using certain parts of your brain.
Absolutely. As we all don't use certain parts of it, we all want to kind of expand the potential of all the different brain areas that we have. But I actually had some more background knowledge because, you know, 20 years of neuroscience experience, I knew exactly what was happening. And I looked at it from a different lens. I mean, for so many years, I was focused so much on the specific experiment that I was doing. What was the next grant I was going to get? What was the next paper that I was going to write? But I turned that knowledge on myself and my own brain and said, there's something not going right here. And I had to do something outside of the lab, oh my gosh, to try and change that. And the easiest thing to do was just to go to the gym. I knew how to do that. My hometown is San Francisco. You know, I grew up in California playing a lot of tennis. And I knew, I just could feel in my bones that I needed to get more active. And so that was the first step. But that was a really important step that really led me to all of these discoveries, personal discoveries first, about what exercise is doing, not only to your mood. I think everybody kind of appreciates that. Even after a good walk, anybody can feel a little bit better. But I was noticing memory improvements, attention improvements. And that was more than just, you know, I wasn't just on a roll. I wasn't just having a good day. There was something really going on. And that's what kind of drove me back to the neuroscience experiments to figure out what the heck is going on. And that's the genesis of the book.
And that's what I love, because you're actually out moving, taking classes, being outside, talking about the changes that you're seeing and feeling. But then you back that up with science.
Yeah.
And you talk about what happens in our brain when we either sweat or when we breathe heavily or when we just get active.
Yeah, as well as meditation. So the class that really inspired me is a class that I took for a long time and now that I teach. It's called Intensati, and it was developed by a fitness instructor, wonderful fitness instructor, Patricia Moreno in New York. And this workout is quite unique. It pairs physical movements from kickboxing and dance and yoga and martial arts with positive spoken affirmations. So instead of just punching as you would do in a kickboxing class, you say as you punch, I am strong now. And each move is associated with a different positive affirmation. And what I talk about a lot in this book is what I call intentional exercise, adding not only the physical aspect that I describe all the different effects, but also the kind of mind aspect. What are you doing declare these positive statements? And what we say in Intensati is that you're replacing all the negative thoughts that we even the best of us go through our minds with a positive thought. Thoughts like, I am strong now. I believe I will succeed. I am inspired right now. And it's silly because you're sitting there yelling things out in a big class with sweaty people. But after that class, I felt so good and so revved up. And that also is part of the reason why I got so inspired. That is what increased my mood. And I know now that what was happening is I was changing my brain chemicals because we know that exercise is basically increasing all those neurotransmitters that are decreased in depression. It increases serotonin. It increases noradrenaline. It increases dopamine, the reward neurotransmitter that goes up when you win the lottery or when you have sex or when you have a really good meal. That goes up with exercise. It also increases endorphins, which we all know is the natural form of morphine in our brain. So you're getting this infusion. But with Intensati, what you also get is what you get from what Amy Cuddy of Harvard says is the positive effects of power posing. So it's a very, like kickboxing, you know, lots of different, you're doing these kind of superwoman, superman poses. You are punching. And that also changes your brain chemicals. Amy Cuddy shows that that increases testosterone in our brain and decreases cortisol, the stress hormone. It also, in studies where she put people in power poses versus non-power poses for just 2 minutes, the people that were in power poses not only had increased testosterone and decreased cortisol, the stress hormone, but they did significantly better in an interview situation where they had to go and highlight themselves. So I was getting all of that with my Intensati class, and I get it even doubly when I teach it because I have to lead the affirmations, I have to write those affirmations, and it's such a fun class to teach. I teach a free class every week to this day at NYU.
Are these classes available in the Bay Area?
Yes, there is one teacher that's an Intensati instructor that lives in San Francisco. So you can look her up on the Sati Life website.
Okay, and we'll put that on our website right after the show.
Yeah.
So let's break this down because it is amazing if you go to a hard yoga class or a boxing class.
Yeah.
And I know that when I leave, I just feel like, yeah, don't mess with me.
Yeah.
I'm feeling really strong.
Exactly.
So what is going on at that point? Can you break it down for us?
Yeah, absolutely. So from the exercise point of view, I just told you all the changes in neurochemicals associated with mood. That goes on. A lot of us feel that. But there's so much more that's going on. And so the other thing that I like to tell people that they don't appreciate is that there is only two places in your brain where brand new brain cells are born in adulthood. So without doing anything, you and I have brand new brain cells born in the olfactory bulb, which is an area important for smell, and also in the hippocampus, an area that I've studied for 20 years that's critical for long-term memory. But exercise even ratchets up the birth of new neurons. So we get even more new neurons born in the hippocampus, critical for long-term memory. I don't know about you, but I want as many brand new hippocampal brain cells in my hippocampus as possible. And studies in animals have shown that if you let rats run on a running wheel, they not only have more hippocampal neurogenesis, birth of new brain cells is called neurogenesis, but they also perform better on memory tasks. So it's not just, you know, new cells. Big deal, you have new cells. They are performing better on memory tests. And that's what I noticed in myself. But the key is that, or not the key, but the other exciting thing that was just started to be investigated in 2007 is a brand new function for the hippocampus. We've known since the 1950s that the hippocampus is critical for long-term memory. But more recent studies have shown that the hippocampus is also implicated in imagination. So people with damage to their hippocampi, yeah, they have bad memories. That's not surprising. But if you ask them to imagine a new situation that they have never experienced before, they don't have language deficits, but they have a very difficult time doing that compared to education match controls. And why is that? The idea is that the hippocampus is not only important for putting things and associating things that have happened to you before in your long-term memory, but it's also important for what they call future thinking, putting possibilities together in your mind. And I have to say, I noticed that after this big change in my exercise regime. I have become more creative than I was before. I don't know if you experienced that as well.
Yeah, well, I think I'm able to do this job, frankly, every day because of exercise and also diet. And we'll talk about that.
Yeah.
Sleep, too, which I'm not so good at. And I'd love to talk with you about that. But with the new cell growth, I often hear people say, you know, I just don't remember what I did a couple days ago, and it's just age, and this is just the new wave I have to live, right?
Mm-hmm.
But you're actually arguing this is actually factual that we have at any age the ability to continually create new cells.
Absolutely. And the one key study in people that have been done that I'll cite shows that, so the hippocampus, this structure really important for memory, the size of the hippocampus goes down naturally with age. The cells aren't necessarily dying, the connections in the hippocampus are dwindling away with age. But people have shown that if you put elderly people 65 and over, on an increased aerobic exercise regime for a whole year, and this was not triathlete, this was walking around the track. That's their aerobic exercise. They their counterparts that did not get that had the decrease in hippocampal size. Their hippocampal size increased. Okay, so that shows that even, don't think that this is for young kids, for middle-aged people. This is for elderly people, and this is when you absolutely need to shore up your hippocampus and your brain as much as possible.
And you don't need to join a gym and go into a class.
No.
A lot of people don't like to do that.
Yeah.
You can just simply walk.
You can simply walk. And what I try and provide in the book is what I call brain hacks. And these are just 4-minute things. They're basically acknowledgement that, you know what, I know no matter what I tell you about neuroscience, it's still hard to get up off your chair and do something. Well, I try and give you hints that or little tips, hacks that you can do in 4 minutes or less just to start getting yourself active. Things like have a pillow fight with somebody. That gets your heart rate up. You know, walk up the stairs. Use the power of music. Everybody has a song that makes their feet tap. Use that song and walk up a hill here in San Francisco. Walk up the stairs just for that duration of the song, just to get that feeling of a little bit of exercise in your life.
And then do you find that if you're not moving, it's kind of daunting, but once you start, you see the effects, and then you almost become addicted to it.
Absolutely. And we know there is addiction because, as I mentioned, one of the neurotransmitters that increases with exercise is dopamine. This is the neurotransmitter that all of those drugs of abuse target. So cocaine goes into the dopamine system and increases it way higher than you would ever get in a normal situation. And that's the reward hormone, neurotransmitter. That is why people have this, I've never felt this way before. And they get addicted to that. Well, exercise is not increasing it that much, but it's enough of a little hit that helps with this addictive property.
I'm speaking with Wendy Suzuki about her new book, Healthy Brain, Happy Life, a personal program to activate your brain and do everything better. Wendy is professor of neuroscience and psychology at New York University's Center for Neuroscience, where she also runs an interactive research lab. She's now also a certified fitness instructor. After she woke up one day and felt like she really didn't have a social life and didn't feel so good, even though she ran her own lab and was a tenured professor, she decided to just start moving and exercise. And she realized that in order to be happy, we have to use all of our brain, not just the part of the brain that's designed for various things. In Wendy's case, it's the neuroscience experiments. She wanted to get active and move, and big parts of the motor areas in her brain were not being used because she never moved. And she writes about this experience and also the science behind the mind-body connection in her new book. And if you'd like to join us, we'd love to hear from you. What questions do you have about the brain? The brain is getting so much attention. We often hear about these brain games, which I'd love to ask you about after.
Yeah.
But it's rare to hear the exercise component. It's almost like, you know, do these games, increase your memory, but what about moving?
Mm-hmm.
So what questions do you have about that? If you exercise, how does it affect your mood, memory, and focus? 866-798-8255. And if you have questions about the science behind the mind-body connection, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Let's talk about what happens to the brain when you're sedentary, mm-hmm. because I've been reading a lot of articles about how sitting is the new smoking,
mm-hmm. yeah.
how so many of us sit all day and well into the evening if we're reading on our computers,
yeah.
and it's so not healthy. It's actually shaving years off of your life.
Yeah, yeah. That's definitely a physiological reaction, probably most involving the cardiovascular system, and that you're just not getting that circulation and moving those muscles. And, you know, it's the brain, I think, is resilient. But what exercise, physical exercise does is it just really increases all these different neurochemicals. It stimulates growth of new brain cells. It stimulates growth factors going on. And it does so many positive things. That's not to say, I mean, there are brilliant minds. I think of Stephen Hawking, who cannot move, and yet he has this brilliant, brilliant mind. So it's not that everything will start to degenerate. What you do start to get problems in your brain, associated with the brain with, is not sitting per se, but if you start eating poorly, and high fat diets and obesity can have negative effects on your brain health and your brain function. So those sometimes go together, and that's where you really have to start getting serious about, you know, changing.
Yes. The New York Times had a piece about this recently, and the headline is, "To Lose Weight, Eating Less is Far More Important Than Exercising More."
Yes.
And it basically pointed out that some people believe that, you know, they can find an hour at the gym, but they can't find an hour to make their own meal at home.
Yeah.
And so it's easier to just grab something packaged,
yes.
and then go to the gym,
yeah.
which really doesn't make sense.
Yes, absolutely.
So that's all. Can you talk about that? Diet is also so important.
Yeah, I mean, diet is so important. And we know that all the fatty foods and high cholesterol foods and high sugar foods are not only bad for your body, but they're particularly bad for your brain. It's a little bit of a double-edged sword, because the truth is that a little hit of sugar can actually increase your attention and help you remember things. But long-term sugar is detrimental to the brain health and your glucose metabolism. Same thing with stress. A little hit of cortisol when you really need it, great. That's what it's there for. It helps you say, oh, you know, I see the fire exit, because there's a fire and I can do that. But long-term stress, which we all are guilty of, you know, engaging in, worry over, you know, chronic things like salary and taxes and how come I can't lose that last 5 pounds, that is very detrimental in terms of actually killing cells in this memory area, the hippocampus, as well as in your prefrontal cortex, important for thinking and personality and decision making. So yeah, very bad.
So stress can actually kill the cells.
Absolutely. Long-term chronic stress will kill your hippocampal cells, and there's clear evidence in people, because people that suffer from different syndromes where we know chronic stress is an issue, like PTSD and depression, they not only perform more poorly on memory tasks, but the size of their hippocampus is smaller.
Hmm.
Yeah.
What else does stress do to the brain?
You know, stress, I mean, the worst part it does is there are these two brain areas that have the most receptors for these stress hormones. Receptors are little doors on cells that allow the hormones to come in and have an effect. And if you don't have a door for the stress hormones, it can't get in. Well, the two structures that have the highest level of receptors for stress hormones are the hippocampus and the prefrontal cortex. And so they become very, very sensitive to high levels of stress. And they basically get overwhelmed. And particularly in hippocampus, there's a lot of work showing that high levels of cortisol will actually kill these cells. And that is just a downward spiral. You can't remember things very well. You know, your ordering of your day in the prefrontal cortex is a big thing. You cannot, you know, do things in the right order. And it just makes it so much more difficult to run your life if you have damage in these areas.
So is it safe to say then that the stress, maybe the sitting, being sedentary, that contributes more to memory loss than age? I mean, I'm sure it's a case by case.
Yeah.
But you often hear people talk about these problems and always contribute it to age.
Right, Right. Age is very variable. As we all know, there are people that have amazing memories into their 80s and 90s, and other people, you know, once they get just a little bit up, they start to, you know, have problems. So it's very variable. Stress is more consistent. The long-term stress for basically everybody will be bad for your memory and bad for your kind of decision-making machinery in your brain.
Wendy Suzuki is author of Healthy Brain, Happy Life, a personal program to activate your brain and do everything better. And you can join us at 8:60. You're listening to a rebroadcast of Your Call, so unfortunately we can't take any of your phone calls. Please tune in live tomorrow at 10 a.m. in San Francisco. Hi, Roji. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Great. It's such great to hear that, Wendy, you're doing such good work with us old folks.
Thank you.
I'm 66, and I'm also did have my problems with substance abuse back in the 80s mm-hmm. and 90s. But once I embraced return to exercise, I'm an outrigger canoe paddler.
Fantastic.
And I got up back in Hawaii, and I'm going to be 66, going to 67. And you're absolutely right about it being the best way to, you know, stimulate the dopamine in the body.
Yeah.
And keeping myself mentally alert and healthy and active. I did have one question about vitamin D, and specifically vitamin D3. I know that it becomes depleted as you age, and my last physical I had last year, I was surprised to find out that I had a severe deficiency, and I was put on 50,000 units for 1 week for 4 weeks straight, and then I'm taking also supplements now. And just wanted your opinion about vitamin D3 and its effect on the immune system.
Yeah, that is not my expertise. I'm like a neck up kind of person. So it's hard to say, you know, there's a lot of talk about the effect of vitamins or food in general on brain function. And my opinion is that, you know, the brain is part of the body, and what's healthy for your body is going to be healthy for your brain. So yes, a deficiency is not good for any part of your body. And if you ask, you know, how many supplements do I take? I'm not a supplement taker, but what I do try and do is eat very healthily and eat in all food categories and not overdo any one or the other. I have been doing fine so far, but I can't comment on the use of vitamin D for your general health.
Well, thank you so much. I mean, it is good to get a vitamin D test.
Yes,
because you
absolutely
can find out if you're in the range.
Mm-hmm.
And so thank you for calling in. Just quickly before break on vitamins, Rob says, do you have any recommendations for supplements? Because in the vitamin section of the pharmacy, there's so many products on to basically saying that they'll improve your brain function.
Yeah. So I'm going to say that again. What's healthy for your body is healthy for your brain. And a lot, as we all know, the other article in the New York Times is about how unregulated the supplement industry is and how little oversight there is for what the heck they say on these bottles. I'm sorry, it is not going to improve. This one pill will not improve your memory. If it did, everybody, I would know about it. I don't know about any of these pills. So I'm not a believer in these supplements.
All right. Well, thank you for the email. Today I'm speaking with Wendy Suzuki, author of Healthy Brain, Happy Life, a personal program to activate your brain and do everything better. What questions do you have about enriching your brain, sharpening your thinking, and increasing your memory capacity? This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
We're listening to a rebroadcast of an earlier version of Your Call Radio. We're not taking calls this morning, but thank you for tuning in. You're always welcome to leave a message at feedback@yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 11 o'clock here on KALW, it's the BBC's World Have Your Say, This American Life at 12 noon, and Snap Judgment at 2. BBC News Hour at Snap Judgment at 1 o'clock, BBC News Hour at 2. All things considered at 3 o'clock here on 91.7 KALW San Francisco, KALW.org, your local public radio. It's 10:30.
Today we're talking about our brains. What does it take to make our brains work better? What does it take to sharpen our thinking and increase our memory capacity? Today's guest, neuroscientist Wendy Suzuki, conducted an experiment on herself and realized that in order to be happy, not just at work, she had to use all of her brain. She also had to get active and move. She realized that big parts of the motor areas in her brain were not being used because she never moved. Now, you don't have to go to the gym. Just walking. Well, I think walking is really underrated. It's so good for you.
Absolutely.
And so she's out with a book about her personal experience and the science behind these issues. The book is Healthy Brain, Happy Life, a personal program to activate your brain and do everything better. And you can join us at 866. You're listening to a rebroadcast of Your Call, so unfortunately, we can't take any of your phone calls. Please tune in live tomorrow at 10 a.m. in San Francisco. Hi, Chris. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call, for engaging in this topic. I would like to know what your esteemed guest has to say about the enteric nervous system and the recent research and evidence that we have more neuronal activity in our gut than we actually do in our brain, and how the two communicate.
So, yeah, that is so, as you just said, the enteric nervous system is part of the nervous system located in the gut, and there's been more interest in that. I don't know if I would believe there's more nervous tissue down there than there is in the brain. I don't think that's true, but I think it's just started to be understood. And you know, this is part of what we define as the mind-body connection. It's how the brain is communicating through these nerves, through this part of the nervous system that is outside of the brain itself, and this one associated with the gut. So, I mean, it's really a new area, and I don't have a lot of specific information about it, but I think it's very fascinating that and very important that we start to understand and put a definition on what we really mean by the mind-body connection. Everybody's heard this term, but yeah, what the heck does that mean? And part of it is the communication. Well, it is the communication between the brain and the rest of the body, and how the body can actually influence the brain, and the brain actually changes the physiology of the body. It changes gastric hormones that are released, and it changes the way that we digest food, or the level of hunger that we have based on what we think about. And so I think part of that, I think the new interest in the enteric nervous system is part of that research, but it's pretty new, and kind of that's all I can say about it right now.
All right. Well, thank you, Chris. I'm actually going to pitch a show about the gut. There's a new book out about it. It's really, really interesting.
Yeah.
Too much information will probably come out in that show, but it's so interesting because people just don't really talk about this.
It's like true.
How important it is to, you know, when you go to the bathroom, and how important that process is.
Yeah.
So thank you for calling in. Let's go next to Margaret in El Cerrito. Hi, Margaret. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call, which is what everyone says. And I want to thank you for bringing up this about the brain. I just put a print-on-demand book about the effects of 5 minutes of going up and down the stairs on the brain before math class with second graders.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, and I really liked what you said about the hippocampus increasing to encourage long-term memory.
Yes.
Because that would really help the kids, as well as the creativity.
As well as that, and attention. What I didn't mention is that some of the most well-established findings in people is that exercise can improve your ability to focus attention and switch attention at will back and forth. And so that is certainly what I noticed when I increased my exercise. And I love the idea of going up and down the stairs. One of the classes that I've created at New York University is called Can Exercise Change Your Brain? It's for upper division neuroscience majors. And in this class, this is why I became a fitness instructor, because I wanted to bring exercise into the university classroom. And NYU told me, well, I don't have any money to pay for an exercise instructor because I'm already paying you. So I said, okay, well, why don't you pay me to go get certified as a fitness instructor? And they said, okay. So they paid for me. I took training, a week-long training. I did 6 months of practice classes, and then I stepped in the classroom. And the class was an hour of aerobic exercise. I taught this exercise that I mentioned earlier in the hour, Intensati, for an hour where they were shouting out affirmations for a whole hour. And then we went into an hour and a half lecture discussion about what exercise was doing to their brain. And not only that, I made these students the actual subjects of my first human study on the effects of exercise, because I was increasing their exercise for a whole semester. And so I tested them on memory tasks at the beginning and at the end of the semester. And it was for fun. You know, I didn't think it was going to be anything was going to come out, because these were healthy students and we were only exercising for an hour. But I learned that while these were New Yorkers and they walked a lot, for many of them, I would say 70% of them, this was the only aerobic exercise they got all week. And so you can ask the question, what happened to them? I also tested a control class for you scientific aficionados out there. I didn't just test the exercise class. It was a real live control class. What I found was a significant improvement in reaction times, actual speed of being able to respond to these memory questions. It was a subtle but significant improvement. And for me, that was a catalyst. This was just a hobby at that point. And I thought, oh my God, if I can see this change in healthy young students, what would happen if I really got them to exercise for, you know, at least three times a week? What kind of cognitive and memory and attention effects would I see? So I totally encourage you to continue your stair walking with your students and let me know what you see in their performance.
A Stanford study has found that walking actually boosts creative inspiration.
Yes,
you brought this
exactly.
up earlier.
Exactly, yeah, it does. So walking, and they did all these controls. They compared walking on a treadmill with no visual, you know, just look staring at a wall versus walking outside versus being pushed in a wheelchair down the same path. And only the walking, didn't matter whether you were looking at the wall or walking outside, would increase your performance on what's called a alternative use task. So this is a standard task of creativity. You can argue whether it's the best task, but what it is they say, they give you an item and you have 20 seconds to say as many things you can do with that item. So brick, and you say, I could make a wall, I could do a doorstop, I could cook a chicken really flat, I could, you know, break a window, all these different things. And they got better. They had more things to come up with while they were walking than compared to when they were just sitting. And yeah, I love that study. I think that's fantastic. I noticed that when I walk home, I get lots of great ideas.
And why?
That is what was unclear from this study. The mechanism wasn't there. And they kind of waved their hands at exercise studies. But we know that the exercise studies are working because of increased heart rate. And they were not increasing their heart rate. That is a mystery. I don't know why. And I think it has something to do with just body movement and the stimulation of that. That's all I can say right now, but that's a fascinating question.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you for calling in, Margaret. Let's go next to Mary in Oakland. Hi, Mary. Welcome to the show.
Oh, yeah. Hi. My question was about brain MRIs.
Yes.
How common is it for a brain MRI to show some spots and it not be clear what's going on? That happened to me 3 months ago. There's no signs of, like, any other neurological disease, per se. Mm-hmm. And the doctor's not sure what it could be, and they want me to go in for a follow-up in a few months. I had seizures as a child and also did some substance abuse 15, 20 years ago. Is this terribly common, or is this, are spots always a sign of something serious in the brain?
It's hard for me to know exactly what you mean by spots, and I'll also say I'm not a neurologist, I'm a neuroscientist. I mean, I think there's a wide range of different kinds of responses that you can get, and it sounds like it's not quite conclusive yet what the actual images see. So I can't comment on exactly how common spots are on an MRI. I'm sorry.
Okay, no problem. Thank you, though.
Sure.
All right, thank you. We have a question from Jody who says, I have a movement disorder mm-hmm. due to a neurodegenerative condition. Mm-hmm. Simply walk is not an option for me. Yeah. Walking is difficult and dangerous. I can exercise in a gym, but it gives me no pleasure. Warm-up and cool-down exercises are depressing because I can't do them. it would be nice to be able to do something as part of everyday life. That would be beneficial. As my condition progresses, my options for activities are narrowing. Any tips for her?
I think that the key is to find something physical to do that you enjoy, whether it's playing with your dog, playing with somebody, playing with your cat. It doesn't have to be the traditional gym class. You don't have to go to an aerobics class. But even, I don't know if this is fun, but one of my brain hacks is speed cleaning your house, because you can actually work up a big sweat doing that. I don't know if this is appropriate in this situation, but are there things that you can do even with upper body strength if walking is an issue, or if, you know, walking or classes are kind of dangerous? Can you do things sitting down with your arms that can be fun? Can you even try something like a hula hoop? Maybe you can't do it around your waist, but you can do it on your arms and, you know, spin the hula hoops on your arms and do kind of acrobatic training in a small sense. Make it fun. Make it so that you do enjoy the activity. And that really helped me.
All right. Well, I hope that helps. Thank you for writing in. And let's go next to Pat in Monterey. Hi, Pat. Welcome to the show.
Hey, good morning. How are you?
Good, thanks.
So my question is this. With all this research that's been done, and the more and more research that comes out, the more and more points to increased cognitive ability with, you know, it's a direct correlation to activity. Why is it that activity programs at schools are usually the first to get cut?
That is an amazingly astute question. And I think that these programs are cut because people simply do not appreciate. By people, I mean the education departments do not appreciate the critical role of physical activity in brain plasticity, development, growth, and health. And that is, in my opinion, one of the worst decisions that education departments make, is to cut physical activity from the curriculum in the name of, we need to give them more time to study. Well, this is empty time, because they're not able to study as well when their attention system is not helped by exercise, and their memory system is not helped by exercise, and their creativity is not helped by movement and walking and exercise. So thank you for that that comment, and I totally agree with you. And it's because they haven't gotten the message, and that's part of the reason why I wrote this book.
Hmm. Is there research on this, or any efforts to try to raise more awareness about the positive effects that this would have on children, or does have on children?
There's absolutely evidence. And so if you look at the age groups in people, where have all of the exercise studies been done? Number one is in the elderly. Not so surprising, because cognitive decline and aging is such a serious health issue. Second biggest population that have been studied is young kids. And so, yes, there is wonderful research on the effects of aerobic exercise on kids, and clear correlations at this point showing that if you are more active, high fit individuals that are young do better at memory tests and attention tests than low fit individuals, young individuals. The least information is known about regular adults, and that's actually the focus of my research.
Wendy Suzuki is author of Healthy Brain, Happy Life, a personal program to activate your brain and do everything better. She's professor of neuroscience and psychology at NYU's Center for Neuroscience, where she also runs an interactive research lab, and she's a certified fitness instructor. And if you have any questions about the brain, how it works, the mind-body connection, the benefits of exercise, we'd love to hear from you. 866. You're listening to a rebroadcast of Your Call, so unfortunately, we can't take any of your phone calls. Please tune in live tomorrow at 10 a.m. at yourcallradio.org. Let's talk a little bit about sleep.
Okay, sure.
A lot of us are addicted to our devices.
Yes.
There's so much to read now.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking from personal experience, staying up very, very late reading.
Yeah.
Exercising a lot, mm-hmm. having a great diet, mm-hmm. but then not getting enough sleep.
Yeah.
What
yeah.
are the effects of that?
Well, sleep is a basic biological function, and it is very, very needed. And it's basically, I mean, we know how critical it is. We don't know all the reasons why sleep is so essential to the brain. But it's basically a reset mechanism. So many important things go on in sleep. There's beautiful research showing that during sleep and during the rapid eye movement, the REM period of sleep, is when memories are replayed and strengthened in your brain. So knowing that, thinking that you're not getting the appropriate amount of time to strengthen those memories. So all that stuff you're trying to put in may not simply not be as effective if you're not getting regular good sleep or long enough time for sleep. There are also other studies. In fact, UC Berkeley has wonderful researchers in sleep that are showing how sleep and power naps can actually improve, just alone, without any additional exercise, can improve your memory. So again, another critical piece of evidence showing that, you know, all of us feel that nap coming on at the end, in the middle of the afternoon. And sometimes that's actually very helpful. And it can rev you up, not a 2-hour nap, 30-minute nap, 20-minute nap. And that's the kind of the time frame that people are, these researchers are exploring. And so lots of reasons to help motivate you to get more sleep.
And why is it when you're sleep deprived, you just sort of feel off? You maybe can't find the word you were looking for?
Yeah.
What happens in the brain?
Yeah. So there are, again, it's a reset mechanism, and it results in these key brain areas, including the hippocampus and the prefrontal cortex, simply not working at their best. And, you know, people can say, well, I could have told you that without being a neuroscientist. I can't remember things. I can't. Words don't come. I'm slow. And that's just a function of you have not. It's like not resting your muscles enough. It doesn't work as well. It's slow. It's creaky. Your brain gets slow and creaky as well. Now, we still don't know the neurobiology underlying the creakiness of the brain, but absolutely, it's as critical for your body and your brain to get this kind of rest.
What about raising awareness? We have an email from Hitesh who says, yeah. I've seen many people who exercise a lot without any significant improvements to their health or brain. What's missing in your discussion is awareness. That is the most critical part. If you don't have awareness while doing exercise or work, you won't have significant changes, or you'll call it in the moment. If the question, he basically wants to just you to spend more time talking about raising awareness.
Absolutely. And thank you for that really important point. So the emphasis in the book is on what I call intentional exercise, which is bringing a purpose, bringing a clear intention to your workout, not just, you can say I want to sweat, but I'm inviting you to bring even a higher level purpose to your workout. The feeling of strength, the feeling of kind of direction in your life can be included using these affirmations, using a mantra, whatever you want to call it. And I think that is very critical. I would question whether there's people, lots of people that have no effect, even though they're not aware of it. If I test you, I will be likely that there's a good chance that I will see significant effects. Now, will I see more effects if you are aware and you are, you know, intentionally trying to improve your brain function, trying to improve your overall health? Maybe. I do believe in the strength of mindset, but I would disagree with, you know, there's nothing happening and lots of people that are exercising. They're clear improvements.
We had a caller who couldn't stand the line who wanted to talk about Lumosity.
Yes.
And so there's this $1 billion brain fitness industry promoting brain training games.
Yeah.
We hear them on the radio all the time. The companies claim that playing a game could make you smarter, more alert, and able to learn faster. And then Lumosity is a San Francisco company best known for brain training. It's signed up 50 million companies, people, 50 million subscribers, $15 a month.
Yeah.
So a lot of people are playing these brain games. What do you think about them?
So my response comes from a recent, white paper that was put out by researchers. Researchers, including those at Stanford, about the effects of brain training. And the answer, the opinion was that these brain training games advertise much ahead of what the actual evidence suggests. That tagline that you gave for Lumosity, that could be given to exercise. And there is much more substantial, real research underlying that, both in animal model systems as well as in humans. And people don't realize that. This is the awareness thing. And again, that's part of the reason I wrote the book. There is so much more hard neuroscience and psychology experiments underlying the effects of exercise in changing your brain, improving your memory, improving your mood, improving your attention. For the brain games, there's certainly no evidence that it's not doing, it's harming your brain. But and you definitely get better at the games that you are playing. So you're playing attention games, you get better at those games. But the key question is, does that translate to your life? Is it just that I'm getting better at Lumosity Game 5, or am I actually better at paying attention? That is the big unanswered question, and the research suggests that there's not a lot of great findings supporting that key question.
Is there much research out there on these brain games?
They are starting to do it, and to their credit, Lumosity is now starting to expand out and trying to get scientists to test their effects of their games compared to other controls and to other kinds of ways to change your brain. And so I think they do work with good scientists and that are trying to get these effects out. But I think that some of their claims are a little bit optimistic, particularly in comparison to what we do know about the effects of exercise on brain plasticity and function.
And sort of related, Sharon says, are you familiar with this Canadian device for depression, the Fisher-Wallace headband? And does it work? I've never heard of this.
I am not familiar with that, so I shouldn't comment on
okay.
that.
Okay, yeah. But they're coming out with all these new devices, right?
Yeah.
We just did a show about cell phone radiation and wireless devices, and this is the future. I mean, so what are your thoughts about that? Because I'm sure there's going to be so many claims about what these devices can do for your brain.
Yes. And so I do know that there is exciting research done on brain stimulation paradigms to do lots of different things, to improve your mood, to improve your cognition. And there is progress being made. I would say it's in early stages. I'm not sure if these very early stage kind of devices now, I'm not sure how effective they really are. But what I do know is this is a hot area in neuroscience research, and there's some really good people starting at this. This is a hard problem. It is not an easy thing that you can just slap a headband on and just, okay, I'm happy now. It's a hard problem, and we still need to, have some research about that.
And for people who are struggling with, getting up every day and doing this, how did you do it?
How did I do it? So I say that there are, three basic ways to start a new thing. You want to lose weight or you want to go to the gym. You can have an immersive experience. So one of my guilty pleasures is extreme weight loss, extreme makeover weight loss edition, where that coach, Chris Powell, goes and he takes people that are at least 200 or 300 pounds overweight. And he doesn't do it in a week. He does it over a year. And they immerse themselves. They get to go to this institute for 3 months and eat there and work out there every day. And then he supports them at home. So that's great if you have that, if a TV show to do that. But most of us don't have an immersive experience. The second one is a revelation. I had an aha revelation when I happened to go on a river rafting trip in the middle of this journey. And, I was a healthy young person. I smart person, and I like adventure. And I challenged myself with going on a river rafting trip in Peru. And I found myself the very weakest person on that trip, just physically weaker. I wasn't terribly unable to do the trip, but compared to all the other fit people, I was looking at them. It's like, I can be that. Why am I not at that level? And that really, literally the day after I got back from that trip, filled with mosquito bites all over my body, I went to the gym, the same gym I belong to today, Equinox, and I signed up. And that, for some reason, being in that environment and realizing I am the weakest person, I should not be, and knowing that I was, but I could, I have the capacity to change. All I have to do is do it. That's what, jump-started me. And the third thing is small habits. If you don't have those two other things, which not all of us do, small habits. And that's why I did the brain hacks. 4 minutes. You can start in 4 minutes.
And now you're a certified fitness instructor.
I am.
Congratulations on this journey. Last question. We've got about a minute left.
Okay.
So many of us are now living longer.
Yes.
We're not necessarily healthier in those later years.
Yeah.
Because there's so much science happening, we have so much knowledge now. What are the next questions that you want to answer in your lab? What's exciting you right now?
Yeah. So that's a great question. And the answer is clear. My next question is, I want to understand, what are the prescriptive aspects of exercise? How much exercise? What kind of exercise? How long exercise is the minimum amount that I need to do all these things, Wendy, that you're saying you can do? Get your better mood, get and keep it. Get a better memory and keep it. Get better attention and keep it. Simple questions that everybody asks me, and then I have to embarrassingly say, well, I actually don't know the answer to that. Those are answerable questions in an experimental paradigm, and that's what I'm going for.
Well, we'd love to have you back when you get your answers.
I'd love to come back, yes.
Wendy Suzuki is author of Healthy Brain, Happy Life, a personal program to activate your brain and do everything better. Also, there's another great one you can look up. It's called the 7-Minute Exercise. If you just search for it, it's a great one if you don't have much time.
I do that one, actually. Love that.
Thank you for joining us, Wendy.
Thank you.
And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.
What impact has the Black Panther Party had on movements then and now? On the next Your Call, film director Stanley Nelson joins us to talk about his new documentary, The Black Panthers, Vanguard of the Revolution. In 1966, Huey Newton and Bobby Seale founded the Black Panther Party to stop police brutality. Nearly 50 years later, the issues the party championed remain relevant today. What has and hasn't changed? That's the next Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you.
Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show. Malihe Raz is on as senior producer. Matt Martin is executive producer. And Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.